You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. Another body was recovered on Friday inside the Nippon Dynaware packing mill in Longview. That employee is the 9th person confirmed killed by the massive chemical tank rupture. It blasted tens of thousands of gallons of hazardous material known as white liquor. Longview Fire Chief Matt Amos told reporters on Friday crews have been slowly mitigating hazards and moving closer inside the plant. They are working to recover two more employees still missing.
So currently we're working inside a much closer proximity to where we're finding the victims, which is helping our recovery of our responders and our turnaround time.
Officials say Tuesday's blast is the deadliest industrial disaster in modern Washington state history. The cause of the disaster is still unknown.
Federal limits on student loans go into effect this July. That could affect the future of primary care in Washington. SBR's Eliza Billingham reports.
Washington's healthcare authority says growth in the primary care sector is slower than specialist areas, thanks to fewer entry-level clinicians, more retirements, and more burnout. Chief Medical Officer Judy Zirzenthuel says another looming factor may slow the pipeline even more.
Limits in borrowing for health professions and new lifetime limits on graduate degrees across health professions, I think, could limit the number of people, especially if they are not of a high income, that are able to complete this type of education.
The Working Families Tax Cuts Act, previously called the One Big Beautiful Bill, put a lifetime borrowing cap of around $250,000 for most graduate students. A Princeton Review study says the median cost of a public four-year medical school degree is closer to $270,000. The private school median is more than $350,000. Zirzenthuel says she expects even more med school graduates will now be pressured to seek specialist jobs instead of primary care, since specialists get paid more. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
Washington State is home to one of the largest communities of Lao refugees in the country. Now, many are facing new scrutiny from ICE. For decades, people from Laos who got a deportation order were able to stay in the U.S. That's because Laos wouldn't take them back. Under pressure from the Trump administration, those deportation orders have picked up. KUOW's Gustavo Sagrero has more.
About a dozen friends and relatives sit on blankets on a stretch of grass, snacking on chips and soda. We're in Tacoma in the mountains out. It's a warm May day. They've gathered outside the barbed wire fences of the Northwest ICE Processing Center. This family is hoping for the release of Kai Sangdara,
yeah, she went to go change into her Crocs.
An uncle, dad, and grandfather to this group.
She found a key and she's digging a hole into the detention center right now.
Sangdara is from Raymond, a coastal town in Pacific County. Sangdara's eldest daughter, Melissa Ekapan, says many Lao people moved there as refugees of the Vietnam War. With the cannery and logging jobs, she said it was a good place to start a new life.
And then being able to live off the land, whether it's fishing or hunting or clam digging. So they've been able to do that. And it's not as hectic as the city. So I think it was a little bit easier for them to adapt to.
Ekapan learned a lot these past few weeks about her family. They hadn't talked about their history like this until now. Her dad, Sangdara, has a decades-old deportation order that was basically put on hold because Laos refused to take back most deportees. He was still required to regularly check in with ICE once a year. Then, ICE sent a letter asking him to come in an extra time back in March. Ekapan tried to go in with her dad.
They told me no, that it was just a check-in. 15 minutes later, he walked out in handcuffs in front of me and my children. And so we've been navigating since then.
During this whole time, Ekapan was facing a crisis of her own. She was being evicted from her home where she was raising teenage daughters. She was fighting to keep both her dad and her house. Her extended family is a mix of different immigration statuses. Ekapan is a citizen, born here, but her cousin, Kamchan Pansasai, is not. He also got a similar letter from ICE around the same time, but got legal help to avoid being deported to Laos, a place he's never known.
I mean, we all came here as babies, so it's like... So it's kind of, you don't know anybody over there.
Sangdara, who's in detention, arrived in the U.S. in 1981 when he was 8 years old. His family fled Laos because his dad and others worked alongside the U.S. military there in a secret war against communism. He eventually got a green card in the U.S. After the war, his family was at risk of being persecuted by a communist government that's still in power today.
Laos wasn't taking us back, so I mean, it was something you weren't worried about, you know, you didn't have to look over your shoulder or anything until now.
Nationwide, nearly 5,000 people from Laos have deportation orders. These are people who had a green card, but then committed a crime that was a deportable offense. Like in Sangdara's case, he pled guilty in 1999 to a drug conviction and later got a deportation order. But for 20 years, Laos wouldn't take him back. In cases like this, the government would release people if they weren't considered a flight risk or a threat to the community. This pattern has now shifted. Last year, the Trump administration issued a travel ban on Laos, putting pressure on the country to take deportees. President Trump's successful efforts in deporting people to a third country also played a role.
But then now, I don't know, things all changed. And then, from what I understand, was Laos government didn't want their people to get deported to some other country that they're not from, you know? So they're like, all right, we'll take you guys back slowly.
When ICE detained Sangdara after that check-in, an attorney saw red flags with how ICE handled it. His attorney said ICE didn't give notice that he was going to be re-detained, which is necessary in decades-old deportation orders like this, a due process argument. Sangdara's previous conviction also got thrown out, because his lawyer discovered that he wasn't told the immigration consequences of a guilty plea at that time. That restored his green card status.
Hi, Pa! Oh, hi! Pa! Finally! Took you forever.
After 2 months in detention, Sangdara walks out.
I get the first hug I ever had. Pa loves me more. Move. This is so exciting. Oh. Oh. Ivory. Oh. Hey, I told you I was making
his immigration case now behind him, free and clear.
I'm not going to the beach and enjoy it. No, I'm not going to go to work for like at least a week. Just trying to feel the freedom and get some fresh air first. You know, it's stressful, isn't it, man?
Sangdara will be out just in time to go clamming for the last day of the season. But he didn't take a week off like he planned. Instead, he went back to his job as a truck driver. His daughter and her family, post-eviction, will move in with him in Raymond. I'm Gustavo Sagredo, reporting.
Tacoma is known for its glass art scene. Glass artists here are crafting hand-stamped medallions ahead of the World Cup. They're hiding them around the area for spectators to search for. NWPB's Lauren Gallup reports.
You want to help me stamp into the hot glass? What do you think? Low five? Yes! Nice. Oh, I like that!
Leah Morgan is helping one Tacoma family of four create some glass art. Anthony Remick walks the family through the process.
Safety sleeves. We're going to throw on some safety glasses also real quick.
Give me your arm, buddy.
Why do I have to wear safety glasses on?
It's a great hands-on experience for the kids, and it's also part of a larger project to make 1,000 glass medallions. Those pieces will be hidden around the city when the World Cup comes to the U.S. Morgan and Remick are the Tacoma artists who were commissioned to make the pieces. Glass is a big deal in Tacoma. For Morgan, glass
feels like it's at like the heart, like the art community in the Northwest.
The artists are creating colorful, flat-stamped glass discs with a custom design. These medallions will be hidden at special places throughout the Pierce County area before each of the games. Morgan says they've been finding ways to get the community involved in the creative process.
It gives them an opportunity to have this experience with like hot glass and something that not many people get the chance to do.
Remick shows how it's done. First, he has to gather the glass from the hot furnace. He reaches into where the molten hot glass is melted.
We kind of just ladle it up on the pipe like so. And we get one little gather right there. We kind of let it cool down. We go for a double dip because we want a good mass of glass on there. Okay. Sounds like Star Wars, huh?
Yes.
Then he heats the glass in the ovens.
Well, I'm just getting it like soupy hot, because we want it really like almost like liquid.
Remick dips the hot glass in something called frit. These are tiny pieces of glass that melt into the bigger piece and color it. Then he cuts the hot glass off the end of the pipe.
So I snip it. Yeah, it's green. This is really, really
hot. He torches it to get rid of the mark from trimming it. Then he drops it onto the metal table, where the kids stamp the World Cup design into it.
We're going to line up, and we're just going to press it right down, and we're going to push. And you see how we're rolling it around. You go ahead, push.
Morgan designed the stamps. In the center, there's a soccer ball. Below the soccer ball is the word Tacoma in English, and above?
So it's the Puyallup tribe's word for Tacoma up here on top. So I've been practicing, but I can't guarantee that I'm doing it justice. But the word is Tal Echlali.
According to the Puyallup tribe, it translates to place of lake, a place name used for the city of Tacoma. Morgan says it was special for her to include the language of the Puyallup people on the medallions. The Puyallup tribe of Indians is the first indigenous sovereign nation to host World Cup events. Together at the table, Remick helps the kids stamp another piece.
Double power. Push, 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 push. I want to see your arms shaking. Arms shaking. And then we're going to spin it around a little bit, kind of give it a little wiggle jiggle, wiggle jiggle, and then we come right on off. Just like that.
Amazing.
And then don't touch though. Yeah.
These two have just joined dozens of Tacomans helping to get ready for the World Cup. Before I leave the studio, Morgan and Remick help me create a piece of glass art too.
I'm amazed that the kids did this. This is harder than I thought it was going to be.
Give it a good push right now.
Sorry.
I want to see your arms shaking. I want to see those arms shaking.
Yeah.
And then right on up. Bloop. Just like that.
Nice.
Oh, it's so cute.
In Tacoma, I'm Lauren Gallup.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Turning now to news out of Oregon. Tonight, Astoria City Councilors will take their first look at a proposed scope of work for a new job they hope will begin to address concerns related to homeless campers downtown. This comes as city leaders plan to pivot to what they're describing as a shelter-first policy when it comes to addressing ongoing issues related to downtown's most visible homeless population. The initiative is meant to increase the ways people can move towards becoming sheltered, but also better support them in that effort. Part of the initiative would also see the refining of rules around public camping. The proposed homeless liaison job is a key component. The draft scope of work city councilors will review tonight proposes contracting with someone for around 30 hours a week of services. The city is tentatively budgeting just over $60,000 for those services. The homeless liaison would be involved in regular outreach on the streets, documenting efforts to engage with unhoused people and providing them with referrals to city programs and community services. The liaison would also help coordinate and support two key programs under the Shelter First initiative. The first is a dry storage program that provides people with a place to store their belongings, and the second is a community-based shelter program. If city councilors opt to move forward with the liaison position tonight, the city would publish a request for qualifications for the contract. City staff have said the proposals contained within the Shelter First initiative, including the hiring of a homeless liaison, could be in place or moving forward by this summer. Overnight closures on US 101 New Young's Bay Bridge near Astoria begin tomorrow night and go through Thursday. Crews with the Oregon Department of Transportation are inspecting the bridge, and the bridge will be closed nightly from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. During the closures this week, travelers should use US 101 Business over the old Young's Bay Bridge and the Lewis and Clark River Bridge as a detour route. This is KMUN.
Last week, a small town in central Oregon shut down a proposal to develop a data center. OPB's Jen Baires reports.
Lapine residents packed a city council meeting Wednesday. They spoke for hours about their concerns over a proposed AI data center. They worried the development could cause pollution, and they argued the power grid in rural Deschutes County is too fragile to handle the additional load the data center would have required. The proposed center's developer, Boxminer IO, said the project would bring jobs and multi-million dollar payouts to both Lapine and its electricity provider. But Lapine city councilors were not convinced. They unanimously voted to halt the project.
And so passed that we will ask to conclude this matter and determine the purchase and sale is closed.
The decision was met with cheers from residents. It comes as data centers' rapid expansion across Oregon and the U.S. have spurred opposition from other communities with similar concerns. Jen Bitus reporting.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has appealed FEMA's partial denial of her request for assistance for damage caused by widespread flooding in December. Kotek previously declared an emergency for 8 counties, including Tillamook and Clatsop, that were hit with landslides, power outages, and other storm damage. FEMA approved the state's request for public assistance, which reimburses costs to repair infrastructure. It denied hazard mitigation funding without explanation. That's the grant to proactively make communities more resilient against future disasters. State officials say that without preparedness money, many communities won't be ready for the next disaster. The Oregon Public Utility Commission has denied PacifiCorp's request for a temporary rate hike. KLCC Zach Ziegler reports.
PacifiCorp asked regulators to allow it to increase rates by nearly 3% while it awaits the results of a currently open rate case, saying it needs the boost to shore up its credit score. Commission Chair Letha Tawney says a utility's credit rating is a concern because it can affect whether or not they can get loans to make improvements or buy electricity.
And so the commission is really evaluating carefully, are we at a point where reliability is at risk or important upgrades are not going to get done? And that really shapes our decision.
The decision to deny the temporary rate hike does not affect PacifiCorp's pending rate case. The company paid out almost $2 billion in claims to Oregonians after its equipment was found to have sparked wildfires in 2020, and the company agreed to forego profits for 5 years. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
This is KMUN.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Because no voters had yet been harmed, a federal district court allowed the Trump administration to proceed with President Donald Trump's March 31st executive order federalizing mail-in voting rules. The order is widely seen as unconstitutional. It tasked the U.S. Postal Service with determining a mail-in voter's citizenship and eligibility upon receipt and return of a ballot. USPS personnel would rely on a yet-to-be-created state-specific mail-in and absentee participation database, which would include citizenship and other information. Pro-voter groups and attorneys general from 23 states argue that the U.S. Constitution grants states and Congress jurisdiction over elections, not the president or USPS, and that assembling such a database violates the Privacy Act of 1974 and other state and federal statutes. Because the database has not yet been created or used, D.C. Circuit Court Judge Carl J. Nichols ruled May 29th that the plaintiffs, quote, have not suffered any harm at present, much less harm that is certain, great, or imminent, he wrote. The ruling doesn't prohibit plaintiffs from bringing complaints at a later date. The suit by state attorneys general remains pending in federal district court in Massachusetts. The USPS has since released its proposal to comply with the executive order. We've linked the decision at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.